I was looking at the news this morning, and it feels like the economy has a personality disorder.
How so?
Well, one minute it's a party, you've got champagne, hiring bonuses, construction everywhere, and then usually when you least expect it, the mood just snaps.
Right.
The factories go quiet, the now hiring signs disappear, and everyone is suddenly very, very nervous.
It's the classic boom and bust. I mean, that's the heartbeat of the modern world, for better or for worse.
Right, but the trillion-dollar question, the one that drives politicians crazy and keeps economists up at night, is why? Is it just mood swings? Consumers getting
Or
spooked?
the Fed messing with interest rates.
Exactly. Or is there something, I don't know, there's something more real driving that roller coaster?
That is precisely what we're digging into today. And to do it, we are stepping away from the cable news shouting matches.
Good.
We're going straight to the bedrock of modern macroeconomics. We're doing a deep dive into Chapter 14, Real Business Cycles, by Kurt Mittman.
And a fair warning to everyone listening, this isn't exactly a light beach read. This is heavy hitter stuff.
It is.
We're talking about the moment economics tried to stop going by vibes and started trying to build like a mathematical machine to predict the future. Our mission is to unpack the real business cycle model, or RBC.
And we really need to stress that word real right at the top, because it might not mean what you think it means.
Usually when I hear real, I just think not fake.
In economics, real means we're stripping away the money. So in the model we're discussing today, there's no inflation. There's no Federal Reserve setting interest
No
rates.
printing press.
None. We're looking exclusively at the underlying machinery. How much stuff we can make. That's productivity, how many people are working, labor, and the machines they use, capital.
So it's like trying to understand how a car engine works by just ignoring the price of gasoline. We're
Exactly.
looking at the pistons and the gears.
We are moving from the 19th century view of crises to modern quantitative macroeconomics.
Okay, so before we can build this engine, we have to define what the car is actually doing. What exactly is a business cycle? Because I feel like if you ask five people, you get five different answers.
That is very true. At its simplest, a cycle is just a fluctuation around a long-term trend. We know that generally, over decades, economies grow, we get richer. That's the trend line going up, but we don't move in a straight line. We sort of wiggle around it.
The wiggles are the cycle.
Yeah.
But figuring out when a wiggle becomes a recession, that seems kind of subjective.
Yeah.
I mean, we have the NBER, the National Bureau of Economic Research. They're the official referees who say, okay, we are in a recession now. But how do they decide that?
The NBER uses what you might call a rigorous vibe check.
Huh, I like that.
They look for a significant decline in activity that spreads across the economy and lasts more than 3 months. They're looking at depth, diffusion, and duration, but it is qualitative.
So they look at a lot of charts and make a judgment call.
Exactly, which drove the math guys completely crazy. The real business cycle theorists, the people behind our source text, they hated that ambiguity. They wanted a statistical definition. They wanted to measure exactly to the decimal point how far the economy had deviated from that long-term trend.
And people have been trying to find patterns in these wiggles for a long, long time. The text lists some of these old theories, and they sound like, I don't know, horoscope readings.
A little bit, yeah.
You had the kitchen inventory cycle every 3 to 5 years, then the juggler fixed investment cycle, which was 7 to 11 years.
And don't forget the Kondratiev long waves spanning 45 to 60 years.
Basically, a human lifetime. The problem with these old theories, as I understand it, is they were just describing what happened. They weren't explaining
It
why.
was pattern matching. They couldn't distinguish between the thing that started the cycle and how the economy reacted to it. To understand the RBC model, you need to get the most famous analogy in all of macroeconomics. It comes from Nutwixel via Ragnar Frisch.
The stick and the rocking horse.
Exactly. Picture a wooden rocking horse sitting in a nursery. It's perfectly still.
Okay.
Now pick up a stick and hit it.
Right. Whack. The horse starts rocking back and forth.
Now look at the movement. The hit from the stick was sharp, sudden, irregular. But the rocking of the horse is smooth, rhythmic, and consistent.
Okay, I see the parallel. The stick is the shock, something hitting the economy from outside.
The impulse.
And the rocking is the propagation, how the economy reacts because of its internal structure.
Yes. For a long time, economists were obsessed with the rocking. But the RBC theorist said, no, we need to understand the stick and we need to understand the shape of the rockers.
But why did this theory take over? Because for decades, Keynes was king. The government thought, if the economy slows down, we just spend money and fix it.
Keynesianism was absolutely king until the 1970s. Then we hit a wall called stagflation.
Right.
We had high inflation and high unemployment at the same time. The old models said that was impossible. They just broke.
And out of that wreckage came the Lucas critique. This is a huge concept in the text.
It is fundamental. Robert Lucas basically said you cannot build a model based on past data correlations because people are not robots.
Can you give me an example of that?
Sure. Suppose the government looks at past data and sees that every time inflation goes up, unemployment goes down. So they announce, hey, we're going to print a ton of money to create inflation so we can lower unemployment.
In the old models, that should work.
It should. But in the real world, people aren't stupid. Business owners see the government printing money. They think, oh, prices are going to rise. So they raise their prices immediately to get ahead of it.
So you get the inflation.
You get the inflation, but you don't get the hiring. The rule from the past breaks because the policy changed people's behavior.
So Lucas is saying you have to build a model based on how individuals actually make decisions, what they call micro foundations.
That's it. You can't just look at the aggregate blobs on a chart.
Yeah.
And that challenge set the stage for Finn Kidland and Edward Prescott. They wanted to build a rocking horse that behaved like a rational human being.
Okay, so they want to build this model, but first they need to clean up the data. We talked about the trend versus the cycle. How do you actually separate them?
This brings us to a tool called the Hodrick-Prescott filter.
The HP filter.
The HP filter, yeah. It's a mathematical formula that acts like a sound equalizer. It filters out the low frequency bass, that's the trend, so you can hear the high frequency treble, which is the cycle.
The text mentions a smoothing parameter, lambda, and for quarterly data, it's usually set to 1600. Why 1600? Is that some magic number?
It's not magic, but it represents how stiff you want the trend line to be.
Stiff. Okay.
If you set lambda really high, the trend line becomes straight as a ruler. If you set it low, the trend line just wiggles right along with the data. So 1600 is the standard agreed upon stiffness to get a useful result.
So they run the U.S. data from 1949 to 2022 through this 1600 stiffness filter. And what do they find? What are these stylized facts?
They found some things that were pretty surprising. First, consumption smoothing.
Which means?
It means people hate volatility in their lifestyle. Even if the economy crashes and your income drops, you don't immediately cut your grocery budget by half.
Right, you dip into savings.
Or you borrow. Consumption is much, much less volatile than the overall economy.
That makes sense. I'm not going to starve my kids because GDP dropped 2%, but what about businesses?
Completely the opposite. Investment is wild. It's 2.7 times more volatile than output. When things get scary, businesses just stop buying machines. Immediately, investment falls off a cliff.
And the workers?
This is crucial. Employment is pro-cyclical. When the economy is good, people work more hours. When it's bad, they work less.
But there's a mystery in the data, isn't there? Something weird happened in the 80s.
The Great Moderation. From the mid-80s to about 2008, the economy just got very calm. But the mystery is about productivity. Before 1985, if the economy was booming, productivity was high.
We were churning out stuff efficiently.
Exactly. And after 1985...
That link broke.
The link broke. Productivity became less connected to booms or even moved in the opposite direction. And that disconnect is a huge red flag for the model we're about to discuss.
All right, let's get to the machine itself, the RBC model. How do they actually simulate an economy?
They strip it all the way down to a Robinson Crusoe scenario.
Okay.
Imagine a single representative person on an island. He just wants to maximize his happiness or utility.
So I'm Crusoe. I have two choices. I can smash coconuts, which is work. Or I can lay on the beach, which is leisure.
Correct. And in this model, what's the stick hitting the horse? It's a TFP shock, total factor productivity.
Which is just a fancy way of saying how easy is it to smash coconuts today?
Yes.
Yes.
Maybe you invent a better rock. Maybe the weather is perfect. A positive shock means you get more coconuts for the same amount of work.
So they built a simple version of this first. Just me, the coconuts, and the beach. No savings.
And it failed. Miserably.
Why? I mean, if I can get more coconuts per hour, shouldn't I work more?
You would think so. That's the substitution effect. Leisure is more expensive because you're giving up so many coconuts by napping.
Right.
But there's a counterforce.
Right.
The income effect.
Which is, I'm rich now.
Exactly. You're so productive. You have a pile of coconuts. You think, hey, I have plenty of food. I'm going to take a longer nap. In the simple model without savings, those two forces just cancel each other out.
So productivity goes up, but Crusoe works the exact same amount.
The exact same amount.
But in the real world, when the economy booms, people work more. So the model was broken.
So Kidland and Prescott added a crucial feature, K. capital they let Crusoe save.
Okay, so now I can stockpile the coconuts, or even better, spend time building a coconut smashing machine.
And this introduces intertemporal substitution.
That sounds like time travel.
In a way, it is. It's shifting effort across time. If the weather is amazing today, high productivity, you say, I'm going to work like crazy today, build up a massive surplus, invest in machines.
And then tomorrow, if the weather is bad, I can just relax and live off the surplus.
Make hay while the sun shines.
Right.
By allowing savings, the income effect, that desire to be lazy because you're rich, gets pushed into the future. The substitution effect, working hard because it pays well, wins in the present. And boom, labor supply goes up when productivity goes up.
So they ran this model calibrated with real data, like the Sulla residual, and how did it do?
It was a shocker. This model, driven only by random productivity bumps, could explain about 70% of the fluctuations in the U.S. economy.
70%. That's huge. But wait, hold on. If this model is right and the economy is just Robinson Crusoe making rational choices based on the weather, what does that say about recessions?
And this is the most controversial part. The theory implies that a recession isn't a mistake. It's not a broken engine.
It's what?
It's an optimal response to a bad situation.
So if technology is slumping or oil prices are high, the rational thing to do is just stop working and wait for it to get better.
According to the core RBC model, yes.
But that sounds really dangerous. If a politician believes that, they look at 10% unemployment and say, don't worry, these people are just engaging in intertemporal substitution. They're choosing to take a break.
And that is exactly why the theory sparked such a massive, massive debate.
Yeah.
It suggested that government stimulus might actually be harmful because it interferes with this optimal adjustment.
But the model isn't perfect. We know that. The text points out some serious cracks in the foundation, especially with labor.
The biggest crack is something called the Frisch elasticity. This measures how willing you are to change your hours if your wage changes. For the RBC model to match the volatility of the real world, it assumes a Frisch elasticity of 2.
Meaning if my wage goes up 1%, I work 2% more hours.
Right. But when we look at actual people, at the microdata, the number is closer to 0.
Yeah, you can't just tell your boss, hey, wages are up, I'm working 50 hours this week, and then next week say, wages are down, I'm working 30.
Most of us are on fixed schedules. We're not that flexible. Plus, the model assumes hours fluctuate because everyone adjusts their minutes a little bit. That's the intensive margin.
But in reality, hours drop because people get fired. That's the extensive margin.
It's not that everyone goes home 15 minutes early. It's that 10% of the workforce goes home and just doesn't come back.
Exactly. So economists had to patch the model. They needed a way to make rigid people look like a flexible economy. And this leads to the concept of indivisible labor.
Yeah, and the text mentions lotteries. This part broke my brain a little bit. How does a lottery explain unemployment?
Think of it this way. Imagine a neighborhood where everyone wants to work exactly 2 hours a day, but the local factory only runs 8-hour shifts.
Okay.
You can't work 2 hours. It's eight or nothing. That's indivisible.
So we have a mismatch.
So the neighborhood agrees to a lottery. Every morning, everyone rolls a die. If you roll a 6, you work the full 8-hour shift and get paid. If you roll 1 through 5, you stay home. But the people working share some of their income with you. That's the insurance part.
So on average, the factory gets its workers, and the neighborhood averages out to 2 hours of work per person.
Exactly. And here's the magic trick. Mathematically, this lottery system creates an aggregate economy that is incredibly sensitive to wage changes. It has high elasticity, even though the individual people are stuck in rigid 8-hour shifts.
That is incredibly clever.
Mm.
It's basically a mathematical hack to make the model fit the data.
It fixed the extensive margin problem. But there was still one more massive headache for the theory.
The jobless recoveries.
Right. Looking at the data after 1991 and 2001, GDP went back up, but jobs didn't. The model said, hey, productivity is up, everyone should be working, but they weren't.
So economists Chari, Kehoe, and McGrattan developed business cycle accounting. They stopped trying to force the model to work and instead asked, where is it failing? They identified wedges.
A wedge, like something stuck in the door.
Think of it as a gap between what the model predicts and what reality shows, specifically the labor wedge. The data acted as if there was a massive tax on work that discouraged people from taking jobs, even though tax rates hadn't actually changed.
So something was punishing work or discouraging hiring, but we couldn't see it? A ghost tax.
A ghost tax. And solving the mystery of the labor wedge is still a huge topic. The text offers a couple of explanations. One is straightforward: unemployment benefits.
Right.
If you pay people to wait for a better job, the math looks like a tax on working immediately.
And the other one involved the man session, right? This one really caught my eye.
This is fascinating. For decades, the aggregate data masked a serious problem. It looked like the labor market was recovering normally because total hours were going up, but that was because women were entering the workforce in record numbers.
So the women were booming, which was masking the fact that the men were crashing.
Yes. Male labor force participation was dropping. Once female participation sort of plateaued in the 90s, the mask fell off, and suddenly this labor wedge appeared in the data. It wasn't a new phenomenon. It was just finally visible.
That is such a stark reminder that if you just look at the big average, you miss the human stories underneath.
It brings us full circle. The RBC model started by trying to create a representative agent, one guy on an island. But the failures of the model taught us that you can't just average everyone together. Men, women, policies, benefits, they all create these wedges.
So zooming out, we started with the question, why booms and busts? And RBC gave us the stick and the horse. It told us that real shocks, technology, weather, pandemics, they matter.
And even though the model isn't perfect, I mean, it really struggles with labor, it ignores money. It was a revolution, it gave economics a skeleton. Every modern model used by central banks today is basically an RBC model with a bunch of extra bells and whistles stuck to it.
It's the chassis of the car, even if they change the engine later.
That is a very fair way to put it.
But I want to leave on a thought from the very end of the chapter. We talked about the great moderation, that calm period where the shocks were small. The text suggests that period is over. It's dead.
It certainly feels that way. The RBC model assumes the stick hitting the horse is a random, you know, standard deviation technology bump. A little better computer, a slightly bad harvest.
But lately, the stick feels more like a baseball bat.
Yes. Global pandemics. Supply chains just collapsing. Wars shutting down energy grids.
That's the provocative thought, then. If the shocks are no longer random little bumps, but massive systemic fractures, can we still use the same model?
Are we back to needing a bigger stick? Or do we need a completely different horse?
That is the question the next generation of economists, maybe someone listening to us right now, is going to have to answer.
A terrifying and exciting thought to end on.
We'll be back next time with another deep dive. Until then, keep an eye on those wiggles.